episode 46 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We're lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government, and I'm joined today by our cast of regulars, Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, now a partner in our New York office, Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, and is now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. Our guest for the day is Shane Harris, author and journalist who's written extensively on intelligence and national security, and recently released the book At War, that's at sign war, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. Shane, welcome.
Hi, thanks, Stuart.
It's good to have you here. And I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, and the record holder for returning to Steptoe to practice law more times than any other lawyer. So let's jump in. We usually start out with This Week in NSA. This Week in NSA is, I have to say, boring, because the only story is Ryan Gallagher's story in The Intercept that is so tedious and elliptical that it could have been encrypted. It's really, he should write all their stories. No one would read them. But I think, and you know, Slate Magazine, before they became kind of a pale imitation of the Huffington Post, used to have this great series they called a series skipper, so that when the Washington Post had like an eight-part series, you could just get the four really interesting stories and skip all the endless prose that they had to generate because they spent a year on the story. I feel like I can do that for our readers with this Gallagher story. I think the essence of it is that NSA and GCHQ are really interested in the GSM Association and in emerging standards in mobile phones, and that they do everything they can to find out as early as possible what standards are likely to emerge, including intercepting communications of the GSM Association, and that they aspire in some cases, maybe, there's really one slide that kind of hints at this, to find ways either to exploit existing holes in the security of mobile phones or to introduce security holes. That's supposed to be what we're shocked about, but the evidence is so thin and it comes so late in the article that I don't think most people would find it reading it because they'd fall asleep before they got to the end. So that's it for NSA. GCHQ, though, is much more interesting. First, there's a decision out of the review tribunal that GCHQ's activities do not violate human rights law. The usual suspects, the people who brought the case, Privacy International and Amnesty, claim that that was always a foreordained decision, which makes you wonder why they brought the case. But I guess they intend to go to Strasbourg and raise it with the Court of Human Rights, the European Court of Human Rights. But again, good news for GCHQ. I want to go back to something that we covered very briefly last week, which was the Intelligence and Security Committee of Parliament, which did a report on the killing of the British soldier in the streets of London, with the guy who gave the interviews with people who had cell phones with him, with his hands all bloody, telling them that this was a command of Islam to carry out the killing. And there's been this elaborate report on how this happened and what British intelligence missed. Nick Bessiano, who's a listener, asked us to go back and look at the MLAT stuff, which I thought was interesting. There's a really long discussion by the Security Committee about the difficulty that they had actually getting information from MLATs from the United States. So obviously, if they are worried about a particular suspect, they want to know what he's saying on Facebook or Gmail or Yahoo or Hotmail. And They will go to the U.S. and ask for the U.S. to get an order against one of those services to provide the information. It takes them 9 months to, on average, to get stuff back from the U.S. And this is, you know, not a country that we think of as having human rights problems or being of dubious status as an ally. And so you can start to see just how frustrating this is when you're talking about attacks that can go from, you know, incipient radicalization to execution in a couple of months. And I thought I'd ask Jason, you took a look at this too, I assume.
What
if anything you learned about the MLAT process from the other side of the Atlantic?
Well, I thought the discussion was interesting, as you did. Full disclosure, we've advised a major U.S. Internet company on these issues, and I could talk about them for an hour and then the process lose the entire audience. But I'll give you a quick take. I think there's three primary issues with the MLAT process, two of which are in the process of being addressed, and one of which is the issue highlighted in this report, which is much, much harder to address. So the first is resources. OIA, the Office of International Affairs, and DOJ's Criminal Division, which is the entity responsible for processing incoming and outgoing MLAT requests, has been underfunded for years, and they particularly not had the staff to handle the literal, almost literal, explosion in MLAT requests seeking electronic evidence. You know, electronic evidence has become important not just in terrorism cases, but criminal cases in every country in the world of every type of crime in the world. And they haven't had the staff to keep up. My understanding, in part based on strong support from the U.S.-based internet companies who have lobbied the administration hard on this issue, that there is an influx of money coming and they're in the process of staffing up, but they could triple their staff and still not have enough. The second,
yeah, they really, I saw that. It looked as though they were spending it almost all on lawyer salaries, which might not be the smartest way to speed that process.
Well, that's a good segue, because there are some process problems that go beyond the staffing. The process is cumbersome. It at its core involves multiple levels of review by multiple attorneys, even within the department at OIA and at the local U.S. Attorney's Office that handles the request before it even goes to a court. And then has to be reviewed. The product has to be reviewed on the way back out. There are discussions ongoing about how to speed that process up. OIA did lobby successfully for a statutory change a few years ago, a law called the Foreign Request for Assistance in Criminal Investigations and Prosecutions Act, which shows you what you can do when you don't try to name a statute, turn it into an acronym. It actually describes what the statute does. Gave them greater flexibility in seeking warrants under ECPA. That is warrants for electronic, content. So you don't just have to go to the place where the evidence is stored, which in these cases is all the Northern District of California, which was getting crushed by these requests. You can also go to the place where the investigation is being conducted or to D.C. And so that's allowed OIA to spread out the burden of handling at least certain types of requests, like for D orders. But clearly there are other changes that need to be made to the process, including greater use of technology so the requests can be made faster and tracked while they're in the process of being reviewed. And there are other things that can be done to streamline it. So that leads to the issue that really is the heart of the criticism in the report, and that's the legal standards. You have to meet our legal standards for obtaining content from our providers, with an exception I'm going to note in a second, non-content too. And our standards are higher. That's an often missed point in criticism of U.S. legal standards when it comes to electronic privacy. But one consequence of our higher standards, and they've only gotten uniformly higher as the department has moved to accepting a warrant for all content requirement and moving away from the 180-day rule and those distinctions, it means they're higher across the board. And that makes it not just harder for U.S. law enforcement to get access to that information, it makes it a hell of a lot harder for foreign law enforcement too.
Right, because it doesn't conform to their expectation. They think they ought to be able to get it based on suspicion or something of the sort.
And we've talked many times, Michael's talked and we've talked many times on this broadcast about the fact that the standards for getting warrants for content in a lot of countries, including countries in the EU, which screamed the loudest after Snowden, are much lower than ours and don't require the level of judicial scrutiny that we require. So it's fundamentally difficult to meet U.S. legal standards unless there's a new treaty. Now, if there's a joint investigation, which you often find in these intelligence cases, there are ways that the information can be provided informally now and followed up later with a formal request so it could be used in court. But But in these cases, you know, use in court is not the primary issue here. But if it's not a joint investigation, and the report kind of alludes to this, that there are certain situations in which they don't want to tell the U.S. what it is they're doing. If it's not a joint investigation, then you're going to be in this difficult area where they can't meet our standards.
So they complained fairly vociferously about the fact that in cases where it's intelligence-driven, it's classified, and they fear that they can't keep their classified information protected if they have to go to court to get the order. Is that right? That there's just no hope of protecting that information?
I don't think that's right. If the U.S. can keep its classified information classified when it goes to court, there's no reason why.
Well, but they go to the FISA court, right?
Right. But still, there are processes in place to enable that to be done in a normal court, or it's possible that you might be able to go to the FISA court if you have to.
That's what I was thinking, is that maybe there should be either a change in the statute or maybe just a change in practice in which we say, listen, this is a case we'd take to FISA. And we're willing to do it for foreign governments as well. Although I think it's probably almost easier for the U.S. intelligence community to say, sure, we'll make that joint. And so the real question is, what is it in the terrorism realm that the British government wouldn't share with the U.S. government?
That's the reaction I had when I read that part. It seems, especially as you said, we're dealing with a country that we are friendly and cooperative with. It's hard for me to imagine there's an investigation that poses a real terrorism threat that the UK would not be willing to share with at least U.S. intelligence authorities.
Well, don't underestimate British snobbery about the U.S. There's plenty of that in which they say, they can't really be trusted with this information. We don't want them to seize these guys and send them to Guantanamo.
Now, there is one other thing in the report that I thought was missing that is often overlooked when people talk about MLAT. There is a difference in what providers can do voluntarily as between content and non-content. The statute provides a very limited set of exceptions to the requirement of legal process when you're talking about content. But for non-content information, that is metadata, subscriber information, user information, providers can provide that to a foreign government voluntarily. The way government – it says they can provide it to anyone other than a government entity voluntarily, and government entity is defined as a U.S. federal or local or state government entity.
Interesting. So they actually can give more to foreign governments than they can give to the U.S.
They can, and they can do that without going through the MLAT process. It's just that the providers, and there's a recitation of each provider's policy in there, the providers don't have to do that, and they've chosen almost across the board to require an MLAT request, which they're legally entitled to do. But if it was a true emergency, at least as to non-content, there would be no restriction whatsoever, and arguably as to content, you know, if there's an emergency situation involving a risk to life or safety, the providers can provide it and then follow up with a request later.
And in some less civilized parts of the world, the risk to life and safety is, they say, we're going to arrest every single employee you have in this country if you don't give us this information right now.
Yeah, it's often a risk to the safety of the employees of the
exactly,
provider.
Exactly. All right. Well, let's move on to Target. There's actual law now in the Target matter, and it isn't particularly comforting for retailers who are under attack. Jason, what did the court rule?
Well, we previously discussed the fact that Target faces over 90 lawsuits arising from its breach last year, including consumer lawsuits, credit card company lawsuits, suits by banks and shareholders. So the news involves a potential class action suit by the banks. There were banks in at least 5 states, including 2 with schools in the college football playoff, who are seeking to be certified as a class, and seeking a whole Target responsible.
You could do your bracket entries based on
who's suing Target.
Yes,
that's right.
Okay.
And, well, you know, there's so many people suing Target, you might be able to do your college basketball bracket based on that. And in that case, the financial institutions had an important victory. They survived a 12B6 motion to dismiss, and the judge held that they had adequately alleged that it was Target's negligence that contributed to or exacerbated the harm they suffered from the breach. And essentially, at its core, the court just held that the banks had made allegations of negligence that were adequate to survive a motion to dismiss. But that's not just bad news for Target. You know, the cost of replacing the cards compromised in the Target breach is reportedly already around $400 million. But it's potentially bad for other retailers, too, such as Home Depot, which we talked about last week, is already facing 40-plus lawsuits after just 3 months. because it arguably clears the way for banks to go after the retailers if the banks can show that the retailer was negligent in maintaining the security of its system.
So one of the things that's interesting, and I sometimes talk about this, is that the very tools that have given us better attribution and a better ability to track people inside our networks are setting up the people who own those networks for liability. Because now you know exactly what happened. And you can point to exactly the place where the guy got in, and it's almost always going to be something that could have been prevented if procedures had been different. So there's always going to be a plausible argument that you were negligent, and
well,
there's
going
to be evidence of that.
And really, at bottom, what you're dealing with is there's just yet another sector of the population that can come after you if they can establish that you were not reasonable.
Right.
You know, you've already worried about regulators, you're already worried about the consumers, and you're worried about shareholders. Now you've got banks that can also say that if you weren't reasonable or if you were negligent, then you're liable to them as well. And it's just yet another thing that underscores the need for companies to be proactive.
I have to say, I think this is where the big money is. And we'll talk a little bit about the Boston Hospital case, where the settlements for pure privacy are tiny because of their problems with the class certification, I suspect. But the banks can say, it cost us $50 to issue a new card. We issued cards that cost $400 million to reissue. And that's the number that's really going to drive liability. I actually think if I were in Target's shoes, I'd be arguing, really, you didn't have to reissue all those cards. Instead, you could have watched the cards you had, because probably 2%, 5% of the card numbers that are actually compromised ever get used. And, you know, your Visa, your MasterCard, you've got all this really great artificial intelligence behind the scenes that you can watch for patterns. Why are you reissuing cards instead of doing that? And the answer is because somebody else is going to pay for issuing the cards.
Well, and that's right. And I think it's, you know, the real risk for the retailers that get sued by the banks is that they don't have, you know, as we've talked about previously, that the way that most of these retailers try to get the suits dismissed is on standing grounds.
Right.
And it's going to be a lot easier for a bank or credit card issuer to establish standing sufficient to get over that hurdle and get the class certified than it is for a consumer or potentially even a shareholder. So I think you're right. This is really where, of all the different actors here who can allege you were negligent and hold you responsible for it, this is the one that I think is potentially going to carry the biggest risk.
Yeah. The other thing it probably says to people who are chief information security officers is that there really is a very big cost of false positives. If you get 100 alerts about possible attacks on your system a day, you're not going to be able to follow them all up. And after a while, you're going to get a little jaded. And that seems to be pretty much what happened to Target. They didn't respond to every alert, and they got burned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about the Boston hospital case, Michael, because it looked to me as though it was like an abject surrender by the plaintiffs.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. The case involved a doctor who had his unencrypted laptop stolen from his office. And that laptop contained the personal health information of about 4,000 patients and some other personal information of about 200 people, you know, social security numbers, names, and the like. But there was no indication that anybody used the information or even was able to access it on the laptop. Or did access
it. Sold it for dope about 24 hours after they stole it. But
who knows? But there was no evidence of that. And the hospital, this is Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, it actually notified individuals anyway, and they turn around and get fined $100,000 by the Mass AG. Now, I will point out there is no evidence whatsoever that this was because the governor of Massachusetts, who soundly beat Martha Coakley, the attorney general, in the governor's race. There's no evidence that this had anything to do with the fact that he was on the board of this hospital. And this may be the first instance of anyone reporting that. I quickly looked it up and figured there was a chance of that. Anyway, you know, I think you can say that businesses can now estimate that the cost of a stolen laptop, at least in Massachusetts, is $100,000. Or as you suggested in an email, you could break it down as $25 for each person whose data is stolen. I'm not sure which way the AG's office looks at it, but either way, it can end up being a substantial sum, even when there's no damage involved. The other interesting thing here was that the lack of encryption actually violated the hospital's policy. So the hospital at least had a good policy in place, but in the view of the AG, the hospital failed to enforce its own policy and adequately train people. So those were the shortcomings involved here.
Yeah, but I would have taken $100,000. I mean, you couldn't have gotten 3 weeks of litigation for $100,000. So this was a good deal for the hospital.
It's still a lot of money.
It is, yes. So let's talk about the really big breach news of the week, which is the Sony hack. That's, you know, it continues to make headlines because it's an unusual hack by any standard. This is clearly not somebody who's just looking for credit card numbers. Instead, it really resembles nothing so much as the Snowden leak. It's a determined attack on an institution by trying to wash all of their dirty linen in public and disclose all kinds of confidential communications, the social security numbers of all their actors, and it's done in the name of a group that no one had ever heard of before, Guardians of Peace, I think, or Pound GOP for those of you who are tweeting. They've never been heard of before. We don't know what their motivation is, but there's been a lot of speculation that this is a punishment by North Korean hackers, probably government-sponsored, for the impending release of Seth Rogen movie called The Interview, in which Seth Rogen and
James Franco.
I was going to say Franco Harris. That would probably be wrong.
that's a movie I would go see.
Are asked to get an interview with Kim Jong-un and the chance to meet with the CIA woman who says, "We want you to take him out." And they say, "For dinner?" She said, "No, take him out." And that may be the only good line in the movie. But it obviously has pissed off Kim Jong-un. They've been engaged in negotiations with Sony Pictures to try to get them to change or not release the movie. But that's circumstantial. I think there's a lot of evidence beyond that. The code compilers and some of the code, I think, was written in Hangul and Korean. The code that is used in this, in many cases, repeats tools that were are identified as North Korean in an attack on South Korean banks and TV stations. I just wrote something for the Hollywood Reporter in which I said, I think the most obvious and most likely thing is that this was the North Korean hackers, although there's surprising resistance to that conclusion around the Beltway and maybe in Hollywood, but I just think that that's the most likely outcome.
I don't know, Stuart. I think you can't overlook the possibility that it was Dennis Rodman sticking up for his own boy. we know they're tight.
Yeah, but there would have been more jewelry involved, I think.
Well, I think there are a lot of people who can't stand the idea of another James Franco movie, and they have some incentive to try to stop that.
Yeah, I think I suggested, let's ask Shane, do you have any sources or any good speculation about who did this one?
I think it was the Sony marketing department, which realized that no. It's although it's gotten a lot of attention to the film, I'm sure a lot of people are going to
want to
see it.
On the other hand, apparently it resulted in the leak of Annie, which confirmed everybody's view that it wasn't worth watching.
That it's going to be terrible. Yeah, exactly.
My daughter respectfully disagrees about that.
No, I think I'm sort of this, just like you said, Stuart. I mean, there are all of those circumstantial pieces that point to it being North Koreans. And, you know, if you're sort of looking at North Korea being like Iran, sort of a country that's gone from having this notional capability to a pretty good one, and it looks like this would be along that curve of maturity that they would be doing. They have motives for it. But, you know, the Hollywood Reporter had, you mentioned actually writing a piece for them, had a piece where they pointed out that some of the instances, some of the techniques in this look kind of ham-handed. So, for instance, there were drop boxes that were used that, you know, weren't necessarily the most secure way of, you know, if a hacker from North Korea was doing this, wouldn't they have known better? They leaked executive pay data, which could, you know, point to potentially a disgruntled former employee. I guess my gut tells me it's probably North Korea. Right. Because, I mean, it seems like something that's so – the whole motive for it just seems punitive. It seems meant to embarrass Sony, to harm their reputation in some way, to punish them for what, you know, the North Korean government clearly thinks is, you know, a huge offense. And I can understand why they do, by the way.
Yeah. But, you know, what's interesting about this is when you look at what governments have done with hacking, it's 98% cyber espionage.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys who are good at this do that. But what we're seeing now for almost the first time is, and certainly the first time on U.S. soil with one possible exception, is a punitive use of hacking that is designed to punish and change behavior as opposed to just steal information. And I think that's pretty significant. The people who've done this, the countries that have done this, are countries that don't have a lot of investment in the current international order.
Right.
The Iranians and the North Koreans, and one suspects they're working together because why not? But this actually changes people's estimate of how big our vulnerabilities are, what it means to be vulnerable. I talked to somebody in Hollywood who said, well, this means the only bad guys we can use are Serbs. And I said, well, and the American government. They said, oh, yeah, they're always bad.
Yeah, but you're right. I think for talking about this with people about this past few days, I mean, I think if you're a Sony executive right now, you have to be pretty terrified. I mean, A, they're releasing pay data, and we found out actually there were two people who were paid vastly different sums for the same exact job. One was a man, one was a woman. You can guess who was being paid a lot more. Competitively, it's terrible for them. You know, if they start releasing star salaries, by the way, that's going to be a whole huge upset.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's actually very protected data. So, you know, even though it sounds like it's sort of, you know, it seems maybe a little bit frivolous because it's movies and who do we care? And, you know, they put a few movies online and people's movies get stolen all the time. You know, for a large global corporation like Sony, this has got to be terrifying. They're using pen and paper to communicate, or at least they were up until last week. It's hugely disruptive to their business and their competitive advantage. And I just wonder if maybe the thing that's interesting also about this case is that it offers a window into those kinds of anxieties that all companies are going to face when people are, you know, hackers are stealing their information and compromising them vis-a-vis their competitors. We're paying a lot of attention to this one because it's a big Hollywood film, but it seems to me that the same pressures that come to bear on executives and how to respond to this would be true if you were Alcoa or Coca-Cola or, you know, Ford or whatever.
That was my takeaway from it too, is, you know, there are certain things that make this sort of sexy because it involves Hollywood and a movie, although I do wonder why no one hacked NBC after 30 Rock had a storyline involving Kim Jong-un.
Oh, several of them. Yeah, right. It was one of the best ones.
although maybe because they had him marrying Elizabeth Banks, they viewed that as a compliment. But there are lessons here to every company. You know, we focus so much, you know, in the press and certainly in our airtime, we spend a lot of time talking about retailers. But this highlights the fact that a risk of a breach goes way beyond consumer information or even employee information. It could be the company's crown jewels or, you know, some sort of proprietary information or assets that are fundamentally important to the company's financial performance. And, you know, studios make a lot of money, but pre-release piracy of a movie that they've invested hundreds of millions of dollars in has a significant economic impact. And they also lost marketing plans. You know, a few years ago, we saw an investment bank whose trading algorithm was stolen by a disgruntled employee. And it also highlights the risk that a hack can pose to your business continuity. I mean, Sony, as you said, was communicating, you know, Stone Age or at least 20th century, yeah, you know, methods. And if you're any kind of company could suffer damage that prevents them from being able to continue the business for some period of time. So it's not just a PR nightmare and a reputational nightmare and a litigation nightmare. You could actually impair your very ability to function.
So, you know, this was a release not unlike the Manning release. Handled, you know, just barfing all the data out, and arguably like Snowden. And, you know, at the end of the day, for all of the pain that was associated with those releases, the institutional damage has turned out to be a little less than that was assumed at the time. And I wonder, if there really is going to be the kind of institutional damage other than lawsuits coming out of this that it now looks like. You know, people tend to be a little resilient, and they may be mad, but there'll be apologies and promises to do better in the future. And I don't know that there's any special liability that they face. They probably don't have that many credit cards. Are all these stars going to bring lawsuits saying you exposed my private information?
You know, I don't know if the stars are getting anywhere with Apple for the naked photo, so I'm not sure that, you know, a lot of that, as it does with any breach, goes back to the question of whether the company employed, you know, what could be considered reasonable or less than reasonable cybersecurity. The more sophisticated the hacker, even if they were sort of ham-handed about the way they did it, the more sophisticated the means of attack, I would argue the better off you are in litigation, because it took a sophisticated hacker to overcome your defenses. But I think the risks here, the greater risks are not in terms of liability. You know, to the extent that employee data is compromised, it creates identity theft risk, and they've reportedly taken steps to address that. I think the greater risk is not in sort of traditional breach litigation. The greater risk is reputational harm, the direct costs of losing, revenue from significant assets like these movies, and just the fact that these guys try to do as much destruction as possible. That's really where I think the
well, and I, it clearly, and then it is certainly true. We joked about it, but it is certainly true that if North Korea tells another movie studio, you better not make us the bad guys, that movie studio is probably going to say, yes, sir, how high, sir, on the way up.
You know, I was thinking about this over the weekend. I don't know if you all remember the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie True Lies, where he plays a spy.
One of the great
movies. And there were protests by Arab American groups over the fact that the terrorists were, you know, Islamic terrorists, sort of undescribed or, you know, nonspecific Islamic terrorists. And I don't know when that movie came out, like late 80s, early 90s. At that time, there was letter writing campaigns and protests against the studio. Nowadays, someone would just log onto the internet and attack the studio online.
Yeah.
So the risks are much greater.
Yeah, I love that movie. In fact, so much better than The Princess Bride, which I finally saw in my effort to catch up on the 20th century culture, which is idolized. But I
better than The Princess Bride.
Oh yeah, no, really.
Wow.
It's not that good.
That's the most controversial thing you're going to say.
You know what? Next week's podcast, I'm going to work a dialogue on The Princess
Somebody's
Bride.
Somebody's going to be hacking you. You better
watch. That's right.
All right. As you wish.
Mandy Patinkin is coming for you.
That's right.
Last thing on this, Shane. This is an unprecedented attack on American soil, on a U.S. company designed to prevent them from saying something controversial. What do you think they're saying inside the U.S. government about their options, assuming it's North Korea?
Too bad, so sad. No, I think that, look, I don't think the United States government is going to be coming to the rescue of Sony. You know, certainly not. They would not make a special case, I think, for retaliation against North Korea based on the inconveniences that this company has suffered, even though there's reputational damage and that kind of thing.
Even though it's going to be the Washington Post next?
If it were the Washington Post, I'm sure they wouldn't come running to the rescue. But, what I think that this does indicate is, okay, let's just, presuming it's North Korea, or presuming it's anyone, really, let's just take the sophistication of the malware and of the attack and of the potential and of the damage that was done, and presuming that more could have been done. What if you then direct that kind of attack at the data of a bank as opposed to its websites? What if you direct that kind of sophistication at industrial control systems? I mean, there, obviously, I think within the intelligence community, people are looking at this and saying, you know, what if the target is different, but the sophisticated weapon is the same? Then you have the question of, like, well, how do we respond to that? Because the DoD has been very clear, attacks on critical infrastructure systems in the U.S., attacks that would threaten economic well-being, potentially loss of life. These are things that would merit a response.
Excuse me, you covered this in your book. The financial system's already been attacked.
Sure, well, the websites have been attacked.
Well, denial of service by people who actually want to carry out banking transactions. So it strikes me that the cheese is getting pared off bit by bit, and we keep saying, oh, not this time, no.
Right.
And it makes you wonder whether we actually have any clue how we would respond to this kind of an attack. And I suspect we don't. We got lawyers and diplomats saying, oh, it's not quite proof beyond a reasonable doubt. There might be a norm against this. And besides, obviously, if it's a contest of which society is going to last longer with everybody eating grass, the North Koreans have more practice. So we don't want to just trade electronic attacks. But the idea that we're just going to let this go means that just as we basically let go what the Iranians did to our banks, mm-hmm. means we're going to get more of this and it's going to be more aggressive.
Sure. And if you're looking at this from North Korea's perspective, I mean, my first reaction was well, why would they sort of waste whatever firepower they have on this one? Why not save it for something really good and don't give away any of your capabilities? But as you said, if they're looking at this that, you know, we're going to get away with it, maybe they can attribute to it, maybe they can't, but in reality, the United States government won't do anything to respond. Well, then why not? So you've basically said to all these actors, go ahead, attack our companies, punish our citizens, you know, cause millions of dollars in damage, and there really won't be a response. I mean, this is now, if you are Sony, though, at what point do you say, okay, but really, we're not just going to sit here and take this, so we're going to have to think about how we respond to this.
So I have suggested that they should fill balloons with 1 million DVDs of the interview and fly them over Pyongyang.
Right.
Just drop them everywhere.
Just aggressively beam it into Pyongyang.
Right, it worked for AOL. So.
Sure, absolutely.
Or they could just drop James Franco into Pyongyang.
Yeah.
Well, you got to really – yeah, that's a twofer, is that All right. One last thing, the FTC is sort of like a black hole. Once you get into its orbit, you are going to end up with a 20-year consent decree, or so we thought. But it looks as though at least one company escaped the black hole. Michael, do you want to tell us about it?
Yeah, thankfully it was our friends at Verizon who did, as you say, manage to escape. They got a closing letter for an investigation that the Federal Trade Commission had launched. And what they had originally charged Verizon with was providing routers whose default encryption was WEP, which, you know, has been criticized by security experts for a while as being ineffective or inadequate. And I think the main reason that the Verizon was able to avoid, 20 years of oversight and any sort of penalty was that they launched a pretty aggressive effort to fix things. They changed the default setting on the routers to WPA. They sent notices to all their customers if they had WP as the default to change it. They have a pretty aggressive program to inform consumers about how to engage in good security and what sort of measures to take and things like that. So I think that sort of aggressive push during the course of the investigation was the main reason that they got out of it.
I can't help. I've got a feeling that the other reason is this was a really crappy case on the FTC's part. As far as I know, they had no evidence of actual compromises. They just didn't like the standard. And it is a standard that has, lost altitude for 10 years. But, to say, you sent it out and it was the default, which means anybody who wanted to could have changed it. And it was basically your home Wi-Fi encryption, which means that if somebody wanted to get into your communications, they'd have to sit outside your home and break your WEP to see what's happening in your network. Not impossible at all, increasingly easy, increasingly trivial to do. But to say that that results in some abuse of consumers struck me as pretty much of a reach.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, so many of the FTC's cases seem like a reach, but I think you're right. This seemed particularly broad in its reach, and I guess you got to give the FTC some credit for getting out of this without inflicting further harm on Verizon other than the attorney's fees that they incurred in having to fight this thing off.
Yeah, but it was a dumb case to start, It has the feel of something that their technologists loved more than their lawyers, and they probably should have done a little more legal thinking about this before they brought it. But yes, God bless them for cutting their losses.
You know, the other thing, it allows the FTC to say, look, we're not completely unreasonable here. Well, we're not unreasonable at all, but they'd put it. We don't penalize people if we determine in the end that they did not act deceptively or unfairly with regard to consumers.
That's right. We've brought 51 cases, and one person has escaped the maw of our consent decree machine. You have a 2% chance of actually getting an outcome that you would prefer from our investigation. We deserve to be praised for that.
That's how fair we are. You know, they say this in speeches all the time, that they really just go after low-hanging fruit and they don't hold people accountable, even if they suffer a breach, if the FTC determines that they acted reasonably. So they can cite this as one of the handful of examples over the last 10 years or so.
I like that. There, instead of that big statue of a guy pulling down a rearing horse in the 30s WPA style that they have outside their building, maybe they should have a guy picking low-hanging fruit. All right. So let's turn to Shane, who's already jumped into the conversation, thank goodness. Your book, At War, Growth of the Military
Rise of the Military.
The Military Internet Complex. I found it really interesting, and I feel like I know this area a lot, but every area you covered where I said, oh, I know how this story goes, there was still something in there that was new, and surprising. How long did it take you to write this?
Probably about a year and a half from the time that we sort of inked the deal for the book and it kind of came out. So, but about a year or so of active writing, but a lot of the reporting just goes back many years before that. So I'd written this first book that was largely about surveillance and, you know, trying to predict and preempt terrorist attacks. And so a lot of the material and the sort of informing reporting that came up there on the cyber side just had no home, really, in that first book. And so it was one of the reasons why I wanted to do the second
book. And you bring in a lot of that as well,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You tell the story of how we iced a lot of Al-Qaeda networks in Iraq,
yeah,
by bringing rapid reaction intelligence gathering, including electronic intelligence gathering, to bear on it. And I think it's fair to describe it, as I told you, as second-round journalism, mm-hmm, rather than some grand meditation on where we're going in this world. It's a lot of great stories.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted it to have sort of a collection of vignettes and narratives. I mean, the first book was a complete narrative with one central character and these sort of four supporting. The central was John Poindexter. And this didn't really have a sort of clear narrative through line, so it was easier to do it as sort of a collection of vignettes and anecdotes that kind of tried to broadly tell a story. And you know, and I think that it's I'm great. I'm very glad to hear you say that you found new things in it too, because as I was writing, as I realized that this is sort of like a book for like the 99% of people who have zero familiarity with this at all. So I think for a lot of people, and it's been interesting as I've been going on tour with the book, this is the first sort of revelation to them that some of these things have been happening. So I'm grateful that it's opening some people's eyes who aren't steeped in the material.
Yeah, that is interesting. It's funny. I feel as though ever since Bill Clinton, the U.S. government has been saying this is a big, big problem.
Yeah.
But no one wanted to listen. I think that's partly because the privacy lobby and most businesses didn't want this issue raised because they didn't think it would end well for the things they believed in. And so they poo-pooed it. They said, oh, yeah, they always say that stuff. You know, they need a new enemy since the Soviet Union went away. And so if you were out in the hinterland and you weren't intimately involved in this, you kind of said, well, I don't know, he said, she said, who knows. But now there's enough stuff that's in the record, you can begin to see this is going to have an impact on ordinary people. Vignettes or things that I learned from this that I thought we ought to at least touch on, the allegation that the big Florida blackout maybe a decade ago was caused by a Chinese hacker wandering around the industrial control systems and who screwed up. You sort of attribute that to a source.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a couple people. This is a very controversial point, too, we should add.
I would think so.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's something that I find, you know, it is more a measure of the kind of the level of anxiety among some people, particularly in 2007 or no, was it 2006? I guess when I started first hearing this story, that people suggesting that it could have been the Chinese that accidentally flipped the switch. It's not a widely held view.
Yeah, so I think it is probably
true.
Company,
so it's not true.
It's probably true that it could have been because, if the forensics on industrial control systems are abysmal. There's just no way to get a log of what was happening on those systems. So you can say that, and it's fair to say, well, we don't know for sure because we don't know for sure. But I'm glad to hear you say, because I was pretty skeptical of that and continue to be a little
skeptical. Although what's interesting, too, is then you have, like, I guess it was in 2009, President Obama gave his big speech in the East Room where he unveiled, you know, his what was going to be the kind of the new grand national cybersecurity plan, and came up and said publicly that our industrial control systems had been probed and we were aware of at least one instance in another country in which hackers had turned the lights on.
Oh, yeah, that was Brazil.
Yeah, well, I mean, everyone assumes it's Brazil, right? He didn't say it, which I thought was, you know, that – I sort of use that in the book a little bit as one of these moments where you say, like, pay attention here. Things are changing.
Right.
The President of the United States is saying this now. And up until that point, it had been one of these things for a couple of years where people in the national security community would very quietly whisper about things like, you know, things may have happened in Brazil. We don't know about China and these blackouts. And it was fascinating to see Obama kind of get up and talk more openly. And then Mike Rogers, even 3 weeks ago, Director Rogers, the NSA, saying that they knew of multiple foreign organizations that were probing our ICS systems. So it's become sort of not the question of whether a blackout happened is obviously separate, but the whole idea of foreign intelligence agencies and military probing our electrical grid is just like now we're saying, yep, it happens. Yeah.
So one of the stories you talked about that I was kind of interested in was the story about the probes to our natural gas pipelines, which was clearly a campaign. They were looking at lots of them.
Yeah.
The idea that they would be doing that for cyber espionage purposes as opposed to trying to figure out how to blow them up seems pretty remote. I mean, there are not a lot of secrets in pipeline construction that you're going to learn from looking at 20 different American companies' systems. So it does seem pretty clear that somebody is – at least thinking pretty hard about doing this, that is to say, sabotaging our industrial infrastructure. Is there anything more about those incidents that would make me less worried or that led to a change in industrial activity or levels of security?
I don't know if it's led to much of a change, and these are, you know, systems that are controlled by such a disparate network of companies and organizations that you can't really have uniform security on, or I suppose you could, but we don't. I guess the one thing that sort of was the optimistic note in this was that these, as far as we know, were corporate computers that were being probed. You know, which again leads us to the more happy conclusion of, no, they're just trying to find, like, plans for what we're gonna build and, you know, technology and the rest of it. But,
That sounds like crap. Because,
well, it's also, it's not a very, very strong assurance, though, is it either? I mean, so it's like, really, you're going to go to a company and say, no, oh, don't worry, they're only in your corporate computer. Oh, great.
Exactly.
Oh, great.
I mean, they could have said that about Stuxnet, too. Iranians could say, well, they seem to be probing our Windows network. Of course they are, because they want to jump to your industrial control system.
Right. And there was actually, I mean, related to this was a fascinating story about a year ago, where there were at least two assailants, gunmen, physical gunmen, who shot up a power station in San Jose, California.
Oh, yeah, we never did catch those guys, did we?
No, and and the FBI is still investigating it, from what I gather. And it was sort of one of these instances where suddenly the physical security of these systems, of the power grid at least, was underlined, the vulnerability of that. There was this period, though, where these gas companies, it was like that. I remember that one summer, I guess it was maybe 2011, I think it was, where it was just there were so many of them, and
That's clearly
systematic and organized, right? I mean, and that's the thing that you can't, even if it is something that is aimed at a corporate system of, oh, we're just looking at the data, or, oh, we're just trying to read their emails. If it's, you know, systematic and organized in that way, it is obviously, it's a nation state. I mean, there's no other organization
that does that. I just assume it was the Chinese. Yeah. That's the evidence, I assume.
Yeah. And I think with a lot of these things with China, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, I mean, I write this in the book, and maybe you take a somewhat different view on this. There are a lot of powerful incentives for the Chinese not to just decide to start turning off the lights and, you know, blowing up pipelines and hitting banks. But the banks, I mean, of course, there's the issue that they're heavily invested in our economy as well. But, you know, I think, and I hope anyway, that the military would, you know, view an attack like that on a physical infrastructure as something that was not a one-off and was probably a prelude to something else. And I imagine that the Chinese assume that we would react in such a way that if they sort of blowing up pipelines, we would figure that this was like a Pearl Harbor event. This is an opening to a conflict, a war. Now, whether or not they've thought this through.
You'd have to be able to show that it was a particular country.
Sure.
And that's harder on industrial control systems than on Windows networks.
I'm presuming that we are gathering a lot of information about these individual attacks and saving that for if it were ever to occur. I guess I'm in the camp too of saying that if there ever was a major industrial attack in the United States, you'd know pretty quickly if it were China, because China would start doing some kinetic things that would link it to them as well. And maybe I'm giving the Chinese too much credit for thinking this through, but it's hard for me to imagine them using a massive cyber capability on its own and crossing their fingers that we didn't attribute it to them, or that we kind of just assumed it was them and responding in some way.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, it turns out that the entire North Korean infrastructure for attacking the United States is in China, because they don't have internet in North Korea, or not much. They could always make it look like it was the North Koreans, because they control the lines in and out of that.
So China's behind the Sony attack.
Yeah, we could take that view.
It could be.
And they'll probably be quite happy to say, well, maybe, it's for us to know and you to find out, because this is a big victory for them. This allows them to intimidate people, to say, well, you saw what happened to Sony. Shame if your studio ended up in the same place.
Nice blockbuster movie you got there.
Yeah, exactly.
Shame if something happened to it.
So, and the other thing that I'd never seen this, put in number terms, you estimated that there could be 20,000, could easily be 20,000 Chinese hackers, looking at the numbers of the one unit that was well identified, which compares to somewhere between 300 and 1,200, depending on how you count them, in the United States. This is starting to feel like, never take on a land war in Asia. We are outnumbered and likely to be outnumbered forever in this endeavor.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, and if you look at, and we're here, we're taking interviews, even in our few hundred, I think we're really talking about kind of the elite cadre of the offensive side of things. I mean, Chuck Hagel has said in the past few months that he wants to grow, that DoD wants to grow the total cyber dedicated force to about 6,000 people in the next 2 years. I mean, that's very tiny. And in that 6,000 core, the majority, the vast majority of those people will be devoted to systems administration and defense. And there will be a much smaller portion of them that are doing the offensive side of things. So, I mean, vis-a-vis China, and it's really hard to get numbers on this, and I sort of extrapolate the estimate based on largely what the company Mandiant estimated was this one particular unit that
Sort of estimating a square footage in the building.
Right, exactly, which gives you also by some indication of at least in the public record anyway how what the sort of paltry, you know, sources that we have to go on in terms of how many there actually are, even though we do clearly know who some of them individually are because we indicted them. But, you know, if it's just a sheer numbers game, then absolutely the Chinese are just going to have more people to throw at it. And you see this also in the sort of the relentlessness and the shamelessness of their campaign. It's just hack anything, throw as many people at it. Who cares if they know it's us? I mean, don't, you know, even try to cover your tracks that much. And they're there, I think they're also taking advantage of just the much larger, you know, human presence that they can toss at this and people working in shifts and just, you know, this is their job. You know, we take a lot more time to train our people and there are just fewer of them. So, and I guess on the flip side though, you know, we would hopefully train them to be much more sophisticated and much more skilled, and hopefully we're going to have to invest a lot in defense, obviously, as well. But yeah, if you're just looking at it from sheer numbers, it's a pretty, you know, woeful situation.
And it's worked pretty well. I mean, I'm not convinced that being really sophisticated actually matters, especially if you spend all that sophistication on trying to hide your tracks, which doesn't seem to matter, right? We can hide our tracks, and then the White House leaks the successful operation, or Snowden does. So in the end, what we've done becomes known. What the Chinese are doing is known because they're not particularly interested in hiding their tracks. And that has led, I'm confident, to countries like North Korea feeling like, well, you know, the precedent's already set. They know that we're in all their networks, that we're just taking this a small step further.
Right, right. And it's interesting kind of also too, if you view it from the privacy perspective, you don't hear a lot of people, at least in the privacy lobby, and I wish they would say more of it, condemning China and even North Korea for the pervasiveness of their spying on American citizens.
No, they believe the true enemy is the United States.
Sure, and look, and there's a global capability that the NSA has designed that I don't know the Chinese necessarily have, but if you're just talking just sheer pervasive relentlessness, I mean, I heard this great, there's a great little anecdote in the book about Lockheed Martin, which, you know, in 2007 was the victim of this huge breach of the Joint Strike Fighter program, and you fast forward to 2014, and they're widely regarded as one of the most sophisticated network defenders of anyone in the defense community. And they were telling me stories about, we can see people coming onto our network, reading press releases, looking for the names of individual executives.
So that they can send the spear phishing
emails. Yeah, and they can also finding out where they're speaking and when and kind of monitoring and tracking them. Not, you know, with an eye towards killing them or anything, but like so they can say, hey, Bob, here are the notes for the conference you have in Orlando next week. And it's just, it's a level of kind of just pervasive, invasive intelligence gathering about individuals that, of course, when we do that, people think that's
shocking.
Crazy and shocking, and it's like, you know, come on.
I think that's right. It's the fact is, if you want any security at all, you probably have to shelter under some government who can provide the protection. And now you've got a choice. Which governments do you think you should shelter under? The privacy groups are so blinded by their hatred of the U.S. government and NSA that they aren't sure there's a difference. That's my guess. It's always – you're always madder about the political differences within your group than outside it. But they're really doing great damage to our ability, the U.S. government's ability to defend attacking almost any new security measure as, you know, the beginning of 1984, which I think the sell-by date has probably passed. So here's something that I was surprised by and intrigued by, and it might help to make up the difference in numbers. You say that the banks were so pissed by the inability of the U.S. government to protect them from these denial of service attacks that have been widely attributed to Iran that they've started to buy 0 days of their own, which is like going out and buying, you know, pretty sophisticated weapons. You kind of have to assume they're going to use them for something, which would presumably be breaking into the systems that are attacking them. Many of those systems are, of course, just some poor innocent schlub who doesn't know how to protect his own online resources. But do you have any idea? Can you elaborate on what's going on there and what we really know about that effort?
Yeah. So I mean, this goes back to the 2012 when the Iranians were marshaling, you know, huge amounts of digital traffic at throwing at these websites. The officials in Washington were deeply concerned about this because of the volume of the size of the DDoS attack, which was not like anything that they'd seen before. So it kind of goes again with this, oh crap, Iran's gotten really good, just like North Korea seems to have gotten really good. The banks go to DHS and they say, what are you going to do about this? And DHS looks at them and says, what are you kidding? I mean, what do you want us to attack Iran? And maybe they thought, yeah, sure, go ahead. I think that when you match that up with then the banks going out and buying this information, we should say too, there is a ostensible explanation for buying 0 day vulnerability data, which is to see whether or not any of those vulnerabilities exist in your system and to go out and defend it against them. That's the ostensible reason for it. But at the same time, as you say, this information would be what you would use if you wanted to mount some kind of a retaliation. And what I find so fascinating in this whole question of hacking back and whether companies can go back and take their information or knock people out who've been attacking them is that it has really advanced beyond the kind of the theoretical, well, what if, you know, what do we think the law would say? Because we know what the law would say. The law would say it's a crime.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay, maybe. You know, there might be lawyers.
I'm softer on that than you are.
No, and there are, this is my point, though. There are plenty of people who I think who come at this like you who say, well, maybe not so fast. And don't we have some sort of right of self-defense here? Don't we have potentially some right of active self-defense here? And I read this in the book that I could imagine, you know, the first quote-unquote cyber war breaking out not between two countries but between Iran and a bank. Because if you are, you know, taking it in the shorts and the government is not going to help you, you're open to potential liability, to loss, and you figured out some way that you think is a legal response for you to protect yourself, I think a company might avail themselves of that opportunity. And the fact that, you know, large companies like banks are going out and buying 0 days, what else would you be planning for?
Well, you know, if they're going out and paying for money about 0 day vulnerabilities, those 0 day vulnerabilities aren't much good unless you also have a whole set of exploitation tools that go around them, and they don't last forever.
Right.
And if they paid for those and actually did use them to, patch their own systems, maybe it's not fair to assume that they're actually planning attacks. And I think it would be very hard to for a bank to actually do those attacks. If I were talking to somebody about doing this, I'd say that's probably having a regulated financial institution engaged in this is probably not the smartest way to approach the problem. And there are plenty of ways in which people can do this and get some deniability. And I would have thought that would be a more likely
use a surrogate
first use.
Or something.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we are running low on time. I promised that I would tell you that I thought that it's a great book, but that it's full of kind of lefty tropes and easy excuses. You know, oh dear, you know, cite. And I it's almost a rule if you quote from Eisenhower's military-industrial complex speech, you know, you can just turn a couple of pages because it's just.
And the lefties think that I'm this pro NSA guy.
Well, so here's my theory is that you share those easy assumptions, but that you're too good at empathizing with the people you interview to just continue to repeat them. So you end up telling the stories, because they're compelling stories, of people you've interviewed. And since we're all the hero of our own stories, you end up telling stories in which people like Bob Stasio are the heroes. And he's the guy who helped nail Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So that it's your empathy and your storytelling, narrative pizzazz that rescues you from the easy New York Times editorial board BS that creeps in when you aren't thinking really hard about telling a story. That's my overall view of this. If you don't share the New York Times editorial board's view of the world, you can still enjoy this. You just have to skip a sentence every 10 pages.
I'll take that, Stuart. From you, that's good. I'll take that.
All right. Well, thank you, Shane. Let's, we always give our guests an opportunity to talk about, events or, speeches or, additional writing that they want to plug. Have you got anything, any speeches coming up?
If you're, I don't know when this will be up, but if you're in New York on Tuesday,
we might make Tuesday.
You might make Tuesday. If you hear this on Tuesday and you're in New York, I'll be speaking at the 92nd Street Y.
Oh, great.
At 7 o'clock on Tuesday, which should be a lot of fun. And other than that, you can find me at Shane Harris on Twitter or read my stuff at the Daily Beast, where I'm covering intel and national security these days.
And doing a great job. It's I always read your stuff. Jason, anything to add here?
No, nothing this week.
And I am blessedly, I don't think I have another speech until January. It's great. And I should tell the listening public, you too will get a hiatus. The next week is our last podcast of the year because we're going to take the Christmas holidays off and then come back January 5. Jim Lewis has agreed to come back on the 5th of January and talk a little bit about China and the current Chinese thinking, at least for Western consumption, about all of these topics. He spent a lot of time in Beijing and Shanghai, so I'm hoping we'll get some interesting stuff from him. So thank you, Shane. Thank you, Jason. Thank you, Michael. Want to remind everyone that the Cyber Law Podcast is open to feedback. As you heard, Nick Bassiano gave us some feedback and led us to change the topic of today's podcast. If you've got suggestions, send them to cyberlawpodcast@steptoe.com. Leave a message by phone at 202-862-5785. This has been episode 46 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. Next week, we have as our guest Joanne McNabb, who is the Director of Privacy, Education, and Policy in the Office of the Attorney General of California. So it should be interesting. She's somebody that Jason attracted to the podcast, so I'm hoping that Jason will carry the burden of the interview. And we hope you'll join us as we once again provide insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government.